This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Welcome. The title of tonight's installment is Race and Genetics Part 3. I wrapped up the last time speaking about Herbert Spencer. And, you know, I had envisioned this series of podcasts here, this thread that I was going to follow, as being a chronological laying out of race and genetics, the biology, the science of race, and tracing the history, at least from around Darwin's time, and I ended up starting a little bit before Darwin, and through into the 20th century and to modern times. And I wanted to lay the groundwork, and I'm still on course to do this, because I wanted to discuss the haplotypes and other modern DNA evidence underneath race and or behind the idea of race, and especially what it means for defining the white race and what it means to white people. But I've bitten off more than I thought it was here, and I have quite a bit to talk about. And it's a bit nonlinear too, because I'll try to keep a chronological order to it here. But this Richard Hofstadter fellow who I mentioned relative to Herbert Spencer really throws a monkey wrench into this whole progression here, this thinking, these white European thinkers thinking about evolution and the origins of life itself and how life is interrelated and what the history is of it. And here comes this Jew, biologically half Jew. His father was Jewish, but he strongly identified as a Jew ideologically. Richard Hofstadter, who comes from the future and retrospectively, pathologizes this whole movement, you know, describes it as social Darwinism. So I want to get into this a little bit in more detail here. Now, Richard Hofstadter, I had mentioned previously, he, besides the seminal work on coining the phrase or popularizing the phrase social Darwinism, and associating it with Herbert Spencer, or Herbert Spencer with it, and painting it as a bad negative thing, he also was the author of a seminal paper or essay titled "The Paranoid Style in American Politics" about two decades later. The social Darwinism thing was his thesis that he published in 1944. Was working on it during World War II, so he was very much trying there to pathologize and demonize the Nazis and tracing back their history, where their ideas came from, you know, back at least as far as Herbert Spencer. And anyway, 20 years later, after the Nazis had been vanquished, he was still at it, still attacking white people. He wasn't happy that the race had been pretty much destroyed as a credible part of science. And he was busy calling people crazy for imagining that they had any interests as a people in America, that white people had interests, that what was going to come to pass, what white people feared was going to come to pass, was just paranoia. It was crazy, is what Hofstadter painted it as. And this was, like his first work on social Darwinism, considered very influential. The funny note here, the sharpest criticism of social Darwinism in American thought, his paper about Herbert Spencer, or his book, thesis, is that he did little or no research into manuscripts, newspapers, archival, or unpublished sources. Instead, he primarily relied upon secondary sources augmented by his lively style and wide-ranging interdisciplinary readings. This produced very well-written arguments based upon scattered evidence he found by reading other historians. So that's the first point I would make here, is that here comes this Richard Hofstadter fella, not a scientist, a storyteller, basically, spinning a narrative. And he has the gift of gab, a typical Jewish trait, and he used it to spin the story in favor of Jews and against whites. And he really derailed, or at least retroactively derailed the whole project of these many men, these many intellects, who were pursuing what they considered to be, most of them anyway, the ones that I've cited, objective science, testable theories, and a view of reality as they could, as best that they could see it and describe it. So the article in Wikipedia about social Darwinism is interesting here. The name social Darwinism is a modern name given to various theories of society that emerged in England and the United States in the 1870s, which, it is alleged, sought to apply biological concepts to sociology and politics. The term social Darwinism gained widespread currency when used in 1944 to oppose those earlier concepts. Today, because of the negative connotations of the theory of social Darwinism, especially after the atrocities of the Second World War, including the Holocaust, few people would describe themselves as social Darwinists, and the term is generally seen as a pejorative. Social Darwinism is generally understood to use the concepts of struggle for existence and survival of the fittest to justify social policies which make no distinction between those able to support themselves and those unable to support themselves. Many such views stress competition between individuals in laissez-faire capitalism, but the ideology has also motivated ideas of eugenics, scientific racism, imperialism, fascism, Nazism, and struggle between national or racial groups. Opponents of evolutionary theory have often maintained that social Darwinism is a logical entailment of a belief in evolutionary theory, while biologists and historians maintain that it is rather a perversion of Charles Darwin's ideas. So my take on this in reading this description of things is some of it's true, and some of it has some spin to it. It's true. I think they're being forthright here in saying and admitting that social Darwinism is a term that wasn't created by the men that it's used and the thoughts that it's used to describe, but it was intended from the beginning to be pejorative. It was an attack on the idea, the concept of a struggle for existence and survival of the fittest, and especially the struggle between national or racial groups. And this, the last paragraph there that I read about the opponents have maintained that it follows logically, social Darwinism follows logically from belief in evolutionary theory. I think that that's probably true too. It does follow logically. It was, those men were just following the ideas where they led. And the biologists and historians today who try to defend Darwin and Darwin's ideas are really just trying to salvage what they can. You know, they think of Darwin as a great man in their mind, and they think he was right about so many things. And usually the attacks are not made against Darwin himself by people who are opposed to scientific racism or the use of science to support racialism and racial ideas, because Darwin is just considered unassailable in what he did. And most of these men that I've cited in these previous two installments, likewise, they are just giants in their accomplishments. And the fact that they believed in race, that there were racial differences, and race mattered, is really embarrassing to the current regime, which according to them, of course, race doesn't matter. And so they have a bit of a conundrum on their hands that they have all of these famous great men from the past who it did matter to and said it mattered and argued that it mattered and provided evidence that it mattered. And so, you know, basically the technique for dealing with that conundrum is to just ignore it and pathologize and demonize it wherever it raises its ugly head. And that's what they call scientific racism. When somebody like me, who isn't a giant, intellectual or famous or anything like that, comes along and says, hey, look at this science and look at this history, you know, we're dismissed as being stupid and crazy and motivated by evil thoughts. Later in the same Wikipedia article, it goes on to say that the argument that Nazi ideology was strongly influenced by social Darwinist ideas is often found in historical and social science literature. For example, the Jewish philosopher and historian Hannah Arendt analyzed the historical development from a politically indifferent scientific Darwinism via social Darwinist ethics to racist ideology. And in other words, she traced, like Hofstadter did, the roots of what led to what they didn't like. Jews decided that they didn't like where race science led, and so they traced it back to its roots and pathologized and demonized all along the way and made the bits and pieces that they could make taboo. Scientific racism, or you could just say racism, social Darwinism are pejorative, of course, but so are eugenics, imperialism, fascism, Nazism. And you know, part of my point in this series of installments here on race and genetics is to pose the situation that it wasn't. None of these things, none of these ideas were pejorative when they were first being discussed. They became pejorative later. And why is that? Why was that transformation? How did that happen? And why did it happen? And who did it? And I've already tipped my hand here. I've already mentioned in the last two installments now that the Jews had a role in this. That, if anything, this vindicates the whole idea of race mattering, because it matters to these Jews that this bit of science, this sliver of science, of all the science that's done in the world, this part about race and biological differences has to be suppressed, has to be pathologized and demonized and forbidden to people. People are not allowed to think about this, and if they try to think about it or try to get published on it, they'll be excluded. They'll be destroyed professionally and otherwise. So you see the hints of this right there in the Wikipedia description of this. It says, you know, the atrocities of the Second World War, including the Holocaust. It talks about the Nazis. It's entirely from a Jewish point of view. So they who is doing this pathologizing, demonizing, is, if not directly Jews, then people who have the best interests of the Jews in mind. And it's typically historians. In other words, you know, people who are telling a story, telling a narrative, and moralizing about it. The struggle for existence and survival continues. And the only difference between before World War II and after World War II is that one particular group now is hobbled in that struggle. Whites, Europeans, Aryans, Nazis, racists, however you want to label this group that's targeted, my group, whose existence has, since that Second World War, including the Holocaust, been under attack, is painted as something that only a morally or mentally defective subhuman would concern themselves with. And that's how it's done. And I went over this in many of my earlier installments. I've already covered this ground about the mechanics of how this happened, and how it's still happening, how it's still done. I didn't get so much into the sanctions that are actually applied, the firing and the boycotting and all the rest of it, the guilt by association that's done. Maybe in a future installment I'll get into that. But I think it's pretty clear to most people that's how it works. You know, every few months you read about some prominent person who said something that upset the Jews, and they within hours and at the very most days come out with a big apology, a big public apology, and or get fired anyway despite their apology. So that's how it works. There's punishment for violating these taboos. So, you know, sometimes the some wise guy will say, well, you know, you believe in survival of the fittest, and you think also the Jews are on top and the Jews rule. So, you know, how does that make you feel? Well, it makes me feel like this. The Jews have the power to modify the environment, obviously. And so they've created an environment in which they're succeeding. And yes, they are surviving. And they are the fittest in this environment that they've manufactured. But I don't think that the situation is hopeless. If I did, I wouldn't be speaking. I wouldn't be doing this research, and I wouldn't be talking about it. I think we can change the environment, too. And I think we're engaged in a war of ideas here at the moment. But it's really, as I've said before, politics is war by other means. And what I'm doing here is war by other means as well, my small part in it. By pathologizing and demonizing any discussion of race, what the Jews have done is that they've rendered themselves and their collective actions invisible, or at least unspeakable. And thus, it's difficult to oppose it. It's unassailable. So that's how that works. The idea, basically, you know, nature is red in tooth and claw. That's like survival of the fittest. Similar thought there. But the idea, the poisonous idea that the Jews have succeeded in selling to everyone, at least white people in general, is that this nature is red in tooth and claw, except amongst human beings. Except amongst white people. White people are not supposed to think that way. White people are not supposed to think of themselves as white. And we're only supposed to think about making a nice, peaceful society safe for everybody else, except ourselves. We're not supposed to even think about our own interests. So continuing in this line of chronological order here, the word genetics was actually coined by a man named William Bateson in 1905. Darwin didn't understand what the underlying mechanism was for heritability. He just sort of understood its properties. And nobody really did understand until about the turn of the century and the beginning of the 20th century is when the science of genetics was first assembled. The pieces were first put together. It turned out that Gregor Mendel had done some of the basic work at about the same time as Darwin, and that became a cornerstone. But another fellow, a German, August Weismann, was fundamental as well. Weismann was born in 1834, died in 1914. He was a German evolutionary biologist. Ernst Mayr ranked him as the second most notable evolutionary theorist in the 19th century after Charles Darwin. So very important fellow. He's regarded generally as the father of modern genetics. He didn't coin the phrase, Bateson did, but Weismann really laid the foundations for it. And his main contribution was what's called the germ-plasm theory, which, according to which, and this was not examining DNA, they didn't know about DNA yet, but they were able to use microscopes and observe mitosis, cell division. And they could see from that that inheritance only takes place by means of the germ cells. This is things like the eggs and sperm. That other cells in the body, what they call somatic cells, do not function as agents of heredity. Okay, so that's an important distinction there, that that there are these special cells, these germ cells, that's where the heredity lives, and that's how it's carried. They still didn't understand DNA. They didn't understand how it was encoded, how it was even possible in something so minute to do that, to carry the blueprints, but they could see that that's how it worked in a gross way. And they also noticed, and what Weissman's contribution was notice that the effect is one way, that germ cells produce somatic cells, but they're not affected by anything that the somatic cells learn, or therefore any ability the body acquires during its life. In other words, genetic information cannot pass from the soma to the germ. And pass on to the next generation. And this is referred to as the Weissman barrier or the Weissman principle. Weissman was an opponent to Lamarckism. And I mentioned Lamarckism previously. Lamarckism is this idea of inherited characteristics, that the giraffe, in striving to reach higher branches, could stretch its neck and thereby pass on to its children a longer neck. This was debated up until Weissman's time, and even a little bit after that. It was a controversial issue. But Weissman tried to lay it to rest, and he did it by doing an experiment where he removed the tails of 68 white mice repeatedly over five generations, and found that in the end, after five generations of doing that, that no mice were born without a tail, or even with shorter tails. And this, at least in Wikipedia, when they mention this, they talk about how this had something to do with claims that Jews were being born without foreskins, Jewish boys. And Weissman, I went to look for the original sources on this, of what he had to actually say about the subject, and it was in sort of the afterword of his discussing his results of his rat experiments, and it indicates, I think, even maybe what motivated him to do the experiment, and that was, he wrote at the end, the mutilations of certain parts of the human body as practiced by different nations from times immemorial have, in not a single instance, led to the malformation or reduction of the parts in question. Such hereditary effects have been produced neither by circumcision nor the removal of the front teeth, nor the boring of holes in the lips or nose, nor the extraordinary artificial crushing and crippling of the feet of Chinese women. No child among any of the nations referred to possess the slightest trace of these mutilations when born. They have to be acquired anew in every generation. So in searching for this original source, I came across the phrase, the Jewish fondness for Lamarckism. And it occurred to me, I had heard previously of the communist fondness for Lamarckism. It was mainly under communist regimes that Lamarckism was promoted and defended for so long. And I sort of suspected that there must have been a Jewish element to that, that in fact, because there was a Jewish element to communism and Marxism. And indeed, I discovered something very interesting, kind of coincidental here. I mentioned last week racial hygiene and in National Socialist Germany and how I didn't know much about it. Well, it turns out that in this issue about Jewish fondness for Lamarckism, there was a very prominent German geneticist, scientist, racial hygienist who talked about this. And his name was Fritz Lenz. And I found two books online, of course, written by these retroactively about National Socialist Germany and racial hygiene. In fact, I think the best book to talk about here and to get an idea what Fritz Lenz had to say and what his thinking was is titled Racial Hygiene, Medicine Under the Nazis. It's a book that was published in 1988, written by a man named Robert Proctor, who is a professor of history and science, history of science at Stanford University. Now, he's not sympathetic to the Nazis, but he's written a series of books that I think at least demonstrates that he's white. I get the distinct impression that he's a white man. He's not a Jew. And what gives me that impression is that he takes a fairly even-handed view. He's genuinely curious about the history of science and specifically having to do with biological race, although he doesn't really describe it that way. He writes about how I am presently working on a book. This is at his bio at his university. He's working on a book titled that he's tentatively titled Darwin in the History of Life, arguing that the 19th century evolution revolution can be seen as an effort to historicize life. Well, sure, duh. That's exactly what it was. It was scientists trying to understand the history of life. And he's fascinated by the subject. So, you know, that's his current interest. And back in 88, he published this book, Racial Hygiene. Now, a large part of this racial hygiene focuses on Fritz Lenz, because Fritz Lenz, Proctor identifies as among the leaders of the German racial hygiene thinking, starting in the 1920s, although his career goes back into the teens. I think the idea of racial hygiene didn't come about until the 1920s. He describes Lenz as getting an appreciation, just to give an intellectual background to his thinking. He got an appreciation of what's called the value problem, which is described as the nature and origins of good and evil, from philosopher Heinrich Rickert. He might be an interesting person to investigate, but I didn't dig into his thinking much. But I did notice here that this idea of a value problem, you know, what is the source of good and evil? What's its origin? Well, Lenz, Proctor describes Lenz as saying that he saw racial hygiene as a solution to this problem, that race is, quote, the ultimate principle of value. And that very much agrees with the conclusion I came to myself, and I laid out in earlier podcasts about morals and moralizing and universalism versus particularism. And I pointed out that, you know, morals, when you talk about something being good or bad, it's in terms of who. That's very important. And, you know, the idea today, of course, is that white people are only allowed to have a universally moral idea of morality, that we have to be thinking of everybody's good. We can't think of our own good. And meanwhile, our lunch is being eaten by everybody else thinking about their own best interests first and foremost, and not even really trying to disguise it very well, not doing a good job of disguising it, and sort of laughing at us about it, even openly, as their power grows and ours wanes. So anyway, furthermore, in Lenz's intellectual development, he was influenced by Weismann and the Weismann principle, and put that together with Mendel's thinking, Mendelian inheritance, and saw that as being, you know, proof of the stability and the substance of genetics as a theory. And he very early on rejected the whole idea of acquired characteristics, the inheritance of acquired characteristics, and Lamarckism. Proctor writes, Lenz's rejection of Lamarckian inheritance was part of the broader rejection of racial hygienists of any substantial role for the environment in shaping human behavior and social institutions. For Lenz, quote, environmentalism could be upheld only on ideological, not scientific grounds. And by environmentalism, he meant the environment's effect on humans. I'm out of time for this week, but I'll come back next week and talk some more about Fritz Lenz. Very fascinating stuff. Please join me.